Well, we saw that front row. Oh,
somebody's gone down.
Who's
what's
that?
What's happening at the back?
That's Juan Mir.
What on earth
and Carol
has gone
Abraham.
On here?
Juan Mir. Well, he's already had four crashes this weekend.
On
we
a
just
warm-up
mentioned
lap.
He's had two in the warm-up. What on earth has gone on there?
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 604. I'm back. I've had a few weeks off, but I am glad to be back. And today I'm here, joined on the show, to talk the MotoGP from Le Mans by nobody other than Jim. Jim, what's going on, man?
Not much, man. Been enjoying the racing. I had a good chat with Derek about the last race. That was fun. It was different. I liked it. But I'm ready to talk racing with you. I think it was some good racing, so we should just get to it.
Yeah, you know, before we get started, we got to do a little bit of housekeeping, of course. We always get a spiel in the beginning, but it never really takes the polish off of it. We do love our donators. Donators, we love you. Thank you so much for giving to the show. Remember, folks, if you want to become a donator as well, just got to head to motopodcast.com. There's a donate button there on the left-hand side. You see the two little PayPal buttons. They're both gold. You can do a one-time donation or a monthly subscription, however you like, however much, however little. It doesn't matter. We just enjoy it. Gets us out to the races. Gets us to the interviews. You know how it goes. If PayPal is not your thing, just head over to patreon.com/motopod and you can donate over there. Every penny does help and every penny does go towards the show. So, all right. We have had kind of a up and down schedule lately, and it has not been because we don't want to do the show or there hasn't been racing. I mean, there's been a lot of World Superbike that we didn't get a chance to cover, and Johnny Ray finally breaking Bautista's streak, and we're going to have to definitely get onto that. And we haven't got to the Moto America, still haven't got the interviews in. Definitely big apologies for that. Life has been crazy for everyone. Jim was just telling me about how his company is going through some crazy new production setup, and I just got done with my finals from school, which I'm excited because that's actually my last finals that I'll take in junior college. So I actually will graduate with my degree in business this summer before going off to Italy, so that's exciting. And then of course Derek has been slam with work. As the snow melts, work gets busier for him. So, just some free time on the horizon, Jim. I'm glad to be back talking motorcycles, especially that we get to talk Le Mans. But let's start off with a little bit of news.
Yep. So, sad to say that legend Gene Romero has passed away. For those of you who don't know who Gene Romero was, he was an American dirt tracker and road racer from the 70s. If you want to know what he was like in his prime, go watch the movie On Any Sunday. He's one of the stars of that show. So it's getting to be kind of scary that a lot of the guys that were in that movie On Any Sunday are starting to get to that age where Father Time comes calling.
Yeah, and unfortunate news today, we got early morning for just racing fans in general that Niki Lauda had passed away. The three-time yep. F1 champ succumbed to, I would say he put on a battle. That injury goes all the way back to his crash he had there in Germany all those years ago. Was it like 1976, I think, Jim, sometime around there?
That is correct. 1976, Nürburgring. He had that fiery crash in his Ferrari where he basically was taken to the hospital and given last rites and famously told the priest to, quote, fuck off, unquote.
Yep. Came back 6 weeks later to finish up, what, 2 points behind James Hunt in the 1976 championship? Craziness.
Drove at Monza in Italy 6 weeks afterwards. He finished fourth. And then later on at the end of that Formula One season, he pulled out of the race in Fuji because he felt like he just couldn't race in the conditions that was there, which gave James Hunt the world championship. It's been immortalized in the movie Rush by Ron Howard. If you've not seen that movie, you should actually go watch it. It's actually pretty good.
Yeah, and Niki had a lung transplant about 9 months earlier this year, and due to some complications from that, he lost it. So both RIP to Gene and Niki. But of course, neither one of them would want us to sit around and saunter very on. They want us to get to the racing. So there's a few more things we want to catch up here. Khalidou Mpaoui has had surgery on his hand after her death and will be out 6 weeks. Now, Jim, we have here in the notes that Pessini is going to get another race, but I don't know if Pessini's going to make it back because there was a wild crash in Moto2 and he came up holding his wrist. And when they went back to the slow-mo, which we may get to a little bit more with him, Baldessari. It looked like his wrist bent the wrong way, so I'm not sure if he's going to make it back for the team either.
Yeah, that was sort of the early news, was like, oh, Impali wasn't going to be able to race, so Pacini got to race at Le Mans, but consequently, Pacini may not be able to race that bike again. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of dropping like flies here, which is not really good, because Laverty in World Superbike had broke both wrists and qualifying at Imola.
Oh, so, what a horrible accident that was, man.
Hell yeah. So all the way around, everyone seems to be crashing and breaking things, which is not good. And it seems like Le Mans every year has the most crashes of any weekend in MotoGP.
It's a tricky, tricky track. There's a lot of things I think the camera hides as far as the way that some of the corners fall off of the La Chapelle. That corner would have my butt puckering the whole time. The way that you have to take that and lean in and attack that corner and put everything on the front end. I don't know if I would do so well there. But, like you said, there's been a rash of injuries lately, and we'll get more along on those to the race. But, Jim, one of your favorite motorcycle companies is making some leaps and bounds here.
Yeah. It looks as though that the KTM R&D department has been very busy between Jerez and Le Mans. They were fabbing up new carbon fiber swing arms for the RC16s. Apparently, after the Jerez test on the Monday after the race, Espargaró and the team think they had found something. He wanted a swing arm. He says, can I have one to race on? And they sort of looked at him like, we think so. But they pulled it off and actually built three or four swing arms, carbon fiber swing arms for the bike. And if that wasn't enough, they actually wound up building brand new frames for their Moto2 squad, which that's a feat unto itself if you're going to build a steel trellis frame and weld it all up and have it ready to go for the next, basically a week's time roughly. But they did it. It showed up early Thursday morning, and the mechanics had to actually put a whole bike together again for the Moto2 team. But KTM is definitely trying. They're bringing different bits and pieces, which is good to see.
Yeah, because they haven't had the start that they want to this season at all, and that's what you want to see the team respond. Because if they just kind of went the Honda way in World Superbike and not do anything about it, well, then we'd be disappointed. But KTM is going to put their money where their mouth is, and that's good to see. Especially, we need that in the sport nowadays, where it seems like money is the one thing teams just don't have that much anymore.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Alex Marquez, there was a rumor, or there's been rumors, that he's been, kind of linked with Pramac because the whole Jack Miller situation is kind of up in airs. They put the word rumor on there. This is exactly what happens in the paddock every single year. His manager went over there and said, hey, we noticed one of your riders' contracts is up. Let's talk about getting my rider into this team. That's all that is. I don't know if you would even call that a rumor. That's just an assumption at that point, right, Jim?
Yeah, I don't see the allure there. I'm not sure what, Alex has obviously had enough of Moto too, I think. He's been there, is this his third or fourth year in the class?
Well, I think it's more than that. I think Alex came up, I want to say he was like 20, like we're talking 12 maybe?
Skyler was totally wrong. Alex came into the Moto2 paddock in 2015. Sincerely, Harry Lloyd's robot friend.
Really? Okay. I know he's been a mainstay in it, but sometimes when you think mainstay, it's only actually, well, it's really only like 3 years. Or 4 years, but yeah, I think he wants to move on. I think he wants to go to the big boy class, but I mean, anybody who's racing in that paddock wants to go to the top of the mountain, and that's fine, but are there really any seats open for him is the question. I mean, there's only, what, 20 bikes on the grid, and everybody's sort of got a spot, but I guess that you're thinking about the fact that, to go to the sort of tie into the next line is that Miller, he wants to move from Pramac to the factory squad. And what exactly are his chances of doing that? Well, I think they're pretty good. I think Miller is a slightly better rider than Danny O. And, unfortunately, Danny had the clause in his contract that he would get a factory bike if Lorenzo left. Lorenzo did. Ducati honored that contract, which good for them. You know, last thing we want is another one of those Dovizioso things where Honda had to wheel out three factory bikes to cover that contract when back way back when. So I think the way Miller's been riding, I think that he probably deserves the factory bike, although I'm not exactly sure as to exactly which spec Miller has. I think his bike at Pramac is probably as close to the factory machines as possible, and it fits behind in revisions. It's definitely behind only by small amounts, but I think Ducati should put Miller on the factory ride and either put Petrucci back on Pramac or look for somebody else to ride. I mean, it's not Danny's fault, but he's the biggest rider on the grid, and that's just his body type.
Yeah, so, and it's the upside thing, right? Age, you know, it's, you know, Miller's probably still on the way up, and Petrucci is probably at his peak right now. And, you know, do you want to wait till he's off the peak and Miller's climbing up his, or gives Miller a chance to go somewhere else? It's tough to see where he would go. That's kind of the thing now, with unless somebody leaves the paddock at this point, it's going to be extremely hard because the guys are so young. You're going to have to wait for Rossi to say, oh, no more, or Dovizioso. These guys that have been staples, I mean, they got lucky with, not lucky, but when, you know, Danny Pedrosa left, that allowed Lorenzo to slide over, and that's what opened up a factory seat at Ducati. But really, had Danny not left, there's probably still not any factory seats that are beginning up to non-factory riders, right? You're just going to do this. It's kind of like the CEO of companies. They make lateral moves. Nobody really goes back down, and then someone comes up. They all just kind of keep it to themselves. So unless the factory guys start leaving, I don't know if they're going to go backwards.
Yeah. Quick question for you. How much longer do you think Rossi is going to ride?
I mean, I would say he would have to start feeling like he can't. And that right now, I would have told you 5 years ago he wouldn't be racing right now. I'm pretty sure I've said that to somebody on occasion, like, oh, in 5 years, he's not going to be racing. And I've been proven completely wrong. He's still competitive. He still does things. He's still got a huge – I mean, who out there is significantly better at this point? The only thing I could really see is you're going to have someone like if Quartararo continues on the pace that he's going, they don't want another Johann Zarco where they're going to let him go, right? With Yamaha, by that I mean. But that's going to take a lot more from – he's going to have to start doing amazing thing and putting together some wins, and more than likely they're going to get rid of Vinales before they get rid of him just because Rossi brings in so much money to that team. It's hard to say when he would leave. I would think maybe they give him his own team and he would still do another 4 years before he would leave. Tough to tell.
Yeah, I was just looking at Rossi's facial expressions this weekend and just looking into his eyes. And I couldn't help but think sort of after the race on Sunday, Rossi kind of had that look like, you know, why exactly am I here? And I'm just sort of curious to how it's going to play out. I mean, we could get to Italy and Rossi will be rejuvenated. All of his fans will be there. And it's a question that doesn't need answering. But I'm wondering, there has to be, you know, is Rossi thinking about an exit strategy, I guess, is the question I'm thinking of. Is like, how does he gracefully leave the sport?
I think he might have started that already with the whole VR6 Academy because he's not going to leave rate the sport. He's just going to stop racing, right? Because he's definitely got his team.
That's a much better way to put it. That's
Because, I mean, he's got his retirement. So
his legacy's there. Yeah. His legacy's there. But I guess it's one of those things where, like, very few people have actually retired from racing at the very top. Bayless is, like, the one guy who comes to mind. Because he was World Superbike champion, said, I'm done, walked away. Stoner, I'm, you know, basically done. Although he wasn't champion at the time, but I don't know. It just seems like Rossi isn't the kind of guy who wants, like, a farewell tour. I think Rossi at some point is just going to just say, nope, not going to ride. So, I don't know. Anyway, we got other stuff to talk about. We go on about Rossi forever.
Let's get on to some actual qualifying now. So, sticking with a little bit of format, we're just kind of going to go into the Q2 of everything, that way we don't have to spend all day on qualifying, but let's start with a little Moto3 qualifying.
So Moto3 qualifying was rather interesting because the weather played such a big part in it, and when the first qualifying session, it started out where everybody went out on wets, but the track was kind of drying, and they quickly figured out that they needed to actually move on to slicks. So coming out of the first qualifying was McPhee, Ramirez, Yuchenko, and Garcia. Now, when we went into the second qualifying session, the question was, well, was it going to actually rain? And it never did, and the guys who came out of the first session seemed to do better than the guys that didn't come through that first session, because they kind of knew where all the water was. They kind of knew where how much grip there was. And McPhee used that to his advantage. He actually gave Petronas Sprinta Racing a Moto3 pole. He did it with a great lap just over Arbolino. Aguro looked really solid on the Honda team, Asia. And then Suzuki was next. Rodrigo after that. Ramirez, Antonelli, Fernandez, Toba, Garcia, Mino, Yuchenko came in 12th. Fanati was down the list here in 13th. Canet was 14th. He didn't really, wasn't able really to get going. Della Porta 15th. Arenas 16th. So the guys that are the fast guys at the top were sort of at the bottom, and the guys who usually aren't necessarily at the front were at the front. So McPhee, not necessarily a good qualifier, but he did really great to get that pole. He's had, it was a long time before he had one, but since I think they said like 2009 or 10 that he had his last pole. So it was an interesting session, more based on just the track and the conditions.
Yeah, no, that's the thing, right? It kind of takes your advantage when you have these two qualifying sessions, when the weather is tricky like that, is to get out there and get some experience. And then you're coming in already kind of warmed up. You know what the track is like out there where everyone else has to feel it around, and you can go out there and push it. It can lead to an advantage in other classes. It can also lead you to a disadvantage, which we might get to in just a few moments here. But nonetheless, still a good mix there in the Moto 3. You know, one thing I'm noticing with Moto 3 and qualifying, like you had pointed out, the fast guys here and the slow guys and these guys all around, it is kind of a shakeup year for Moto 3. There isn't a clear favorite, and you're starting to see names come to the front that weren't necessarily household names at the sharp end of the racing stick there. You know, like Suzuki's having a resurgence of a year, right? Qualifying, racing, everything. He's running at the front with the Squadra Course team. And we didn't really see that last year. In fact, we didn't really see either of the riders moving too much to the front. Now it's like, okay, this year he went back and got his head right. I don't know. Another year of maturity, another year of skill. But definitely getting hard to call who is a favorite. There's no such thing, I think, right now in the Moto3 paddock.
No, not really. I think if anyone is a favorite, I think you'd have to say Canet, and that would be... that'd be it. Other than that, it's pretty much a wild flip of the coin kind of scenario.
All right, so that takes us to the Moto3 race. Now, in the beginning of this race, we all kind of sat around and waited, like, is it going to rain? Because there's been a whole threat of rain this weekend. Around Sunday, they said it was going to rain, then there was a chance of rain. It was really overcast. It was pretty dark. And so you're thinking to yourself, like, oh, okay, does something need to make a gamble? Nope, all went out there on slicks to start off with the race. We're like, okay, let's see how it goes, because Moto3 doesn't have the flag-to-flag, and they actually have to stop the race and start it. So really, there's no point in taking a risk with rain tires, because you have to come in and change anyway. So that's out the bag. But anyway, in the beginning of the race, Jim, there was a scary, scary crash at Iogara, high-siding on the bike, but the bike was coming back onto the track and started to tumble right there in the middle. And I have to say this, it's lucky that no one hit that bike, but it's also lucky that crash happened in Moto3, because the bikes do go a bit slower. I think it gives them a little bit quicker or a little bit more time to react to something like that in the track, because the closing speed is so great. That happens in GP or Moto2. I don't know if it's the same results.
I would agree with you. That was a vicious high side. And, you know, he was fairly far outside. It was a power on high side. It was not a tuck and then grip and then flip you off kind of a high side that you generally see in Moto3. It was definitely just all the back end, which led to chaos that ensuing after that. And again, I think it was a weird bounce. The bike kind of hit rear tire first, and the energy took it back towards the racing surface. And I was screaming at the screen going, nobody hit the bike, nobody hit the bike, nobody hit the bike, because I could just see super bad things happening again when someone hits a bike. Because then now there's not one thing to dodge. There are several objects you have to dodge, and they're going at different velocities. You know, a rider sliding across the track is going to move and slow down at a different speed than the bike tumbling at that, and you got to somehow calculate all that in and make a decision of where you're going to go and hope that the person and the bike aren't going to be where you think they're going to be in that split second. So it shows you the level of concentration and reflexes that these guys actually have, that they can think about that and compute all of that and figure out that, like, yeah, this is where I need to go, and this is what's not going to happen. Which, if anyone believes we're going to have autonomous cars driving by computers, make them figure out how to get through that situation, and then I'll get in that car. But until then, nothing is better than the human brain at calculating out where you're going to go and what to do in those moments.
Maybe in your state. You haven't driven in mine.
Well, I have driven in California. You need autonomous cars just because everybody there's an idiot.
Oh, my God.
Anyway.
Every day. Anywho, that's a whole different podcast. Now, like I had mentioned before there in qualifying, we saw Suzuki get up there and grab the early lead. And he was looking good. He was taking a commanding lead. He was actually starting to pull a gap, which is extremely hard in Moto3, but maybe running his tires off a little bit early in the race. But
remember, Suzuki was the only person who went for a soft front tire on his Moto3 bike. So that was the only thing that was different, but we're starting to see a pattern in Moto3. Suzuki qualifies fairly well. First two rows, basically, and then he somehow gets himself to the front and he takes off. Like, his strategy is, I'm going to go as fast as humanly possible here, and if you guys can come with me, go ahead. And at the beginning, McPhee, he couldn't go with them, and neither could Kinect. Both those guys start to slide down the field as opposed to being at the front. So I don't know if that's Suzuki's strategy from now is to do that, but I'm thinking, gosh, buddy, I wish you got to stay there if you're going to go out front and be that good. You got to have all their ducks in a row to be sure that you can actually stay there the whole time.
Finish is what we want. I mean, when we danced around it, I mean, it was, yeah, we had the race kind of, you know, got to a little bit there of a lull, as a much of a lull as Moto 3 gets, right?
It was basically quiet.
It was a couple passes a lap instead of 10 passes a lap, mm-hmm. But you know, we saw Antonelli, unfortunately, he crashed out. So the guy goes from the highs to the lows. Hopefully that doesn't wreck his confidence too much and he can bounce back from that. Fanati pulled in. That's three DNFs in a row.
Yeah, but he had that very, very wicked high side in free practice, and he was hurting. I don't blame Fanati for this one. I'd still be hurting. I couldn't be walking, let alone riding. So kudos to Fanati for even trying.
Yeah, and it's, you know, a bit of a rough start for him. And then as soon as I was putting those notes in, I'm like, oh, look, Suzuki kind of, he made a mistake. He went back to fourth, you know, got caught up. But then right away, he was right back to the front, made some nice moves. You're thinking, like, okay, he's going to be up there. And then he just washed the front end in the chicane. And unfortunately, he slid off the bike and took out Tony Aberlino as well. And it's like, ah, dude, you were so close to getting it on the podium, which missed out in the last race as well, and we didn't finish. And oh man, I think they cut to his mom in the pits of shoes.
Oh yeah,
oh man, the tears. And yep. It wasn't because she was sad. I think she feels it for her kid going down. Like, he's worked that hard, and oh man, that's a tough one to watch.
But here's the cool thing about Suzuki, in my opinion. This is the first race where we've seen him go out. He would make a mistake, go backwards, or be passed, and he attacked again. He got back to the front, and he did it twice. He was out front, made a small mistake, got past, came right back at it again. Went back to the front, stay there for a little bit. The guys kind of had to stop and regroup and go, whoa, that's a little different from the norm here. Let's figure out what we're going to do. And then, you know, they put the pressure on him. Again, he made a mistake. He went wide, I think, at Museum. But then he got it back together again. I think he was down to fourth, but he rode himself back to the front of the pack until he had that crash. But it was good to see that improvement. You know, instead of being out front and then laying down and not really putting any fight in, he put fight back in, which is great to see.
Now you got to have that, right?
Oh, yeah.
That crash ended up spreading out the field. So you're thinking, oh, it's a two-rider battle now. Because I think at the time it was McPhee and come on, Brain. Who was out there with McPhee at that point? Oh, this is why we're supposed to write notes.
Well, how can you write notes during Moto 3? Because it's just that good.
It's tough. I think maybe it was Ramirez that was with him at the time. Anyway, it doesn't matter because it just leads to my next point anyway, that we thought it was going to be these two guys take off, and then all of a sudden with, what, two laps to go, we've got a 12-rider battle for the lead.
That was De La Porta and McPhee. Those two were out front after the crash. That was De La Porta and McPhee.
There you go.
Yep. So they had gapped everybody, but then Minio, he brought everybody back again. So you had like six riders battling in there, and even Toba had caught up, and you got to that
group
of like 12.
Toba came out of nowhere
again,
to get onto that group.
That's a norm now. Toba comes out of nowhere and just shows up at the end of the race going, hey, I got pace. Didn't see that coming.
He needs to go a little bit faster at the beginning because obviously he can manage his tires really well. Oh, and then speaking of Kaito Toba, oh, dude. Kinnett used him as a berm to kind of get in there in that last lap, and that was a harsh move, one that Toba should have known was coming, and that's what he's going to learn from his racecraft. But that wasn't the part that kind of bothered me. What bothered me is that when Toba came up and like tapped Kinnett at the end of the race on the shoulder, like, dude, what the hell? The reaction of Kinnett. There's something about that, ooh, what? Ooh, whoa, this hands up kind of thing. Like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Oh, man, that I would not be able to handle that well if I was in the same place as Toba. Ooh.
That reminds me of somebody else who did that a lot. And he happens to be the guy that Kinnett rides for. Biaggi did that. You know, Biaggi had that same attitude. Like, oh, you know, he could rough anybody up that he wanted to rough up. And you called him on it, and he would just look at you and go, what, me? I was just riding a race, you know, and that was his thing. And I don't really remember Kinnett being that way prior to his association with Biaggi. Now, I'm not.
He's been a hothead. He got in trouble, what was that, in Argentina last year when he was it Yurchenko? You're trying to run him off the track or something like that? He's definitely had his moments, and he gets the red mist pretty bad. That's what led to so many inconsistent races.
Yeah, but it's the aftermath of the red mist. It's the, oh, I didn't do anything concept that is kind of different. I mean, I'm not saying that he wasn't a hothead before. I guess I just didn't make that clear. Like, the thought was in my head, but sometimes what I think in my head and what comes out of my mouth don't match.
But, you know what it is? He grew a mustache.
Oh.
That's what changed.
Okay, all right, there we go. That works.
I mean, it's the same reason Vinales is having so many issues. He's got to cut it off.
Aerodynamic, go faster.
Mustache podcast. All right, here we go. but yeah, McPhee finished up. He had a great race because he didn't look like he was going to win it at the point. He looked like he was in it to win it, but he never was making that threat at the end and just made a really smart couple of moves towards the end of the race to put himself in the position to get through the last couple of corners in the lead, which where it's really hard to pass, and get the win. His first win in the dry, which was a huge bonus because you always get that staple on you. Yeah, you got to win, but it was in a wet. It's like, dude, a win is a win. Don't take away it from anybody, right?
Agreed.
But then also Petronas, you know, they get their first win in Moto3 with that team. They brought him in to do the job. He does the job. And you can definitely tell there was that, not only am I excited about winning, but whew, man, the monkey's off the back kind of feeling. And I wonder if that's going to, you know, sometimes when these guys start winning, that ball of confidence keeps going and it just leads to more wins.
Yep. I think so. I hope so. I'd like to see McPhee win some more races. But I'm wondering if the track conditions didn't play into his winning ability. Not trying to take anything away from John McPhee. It was a great ride, fantastic ride. But the track was so cold that it kind of had to be ridden like a wet racetrack. You see where I'm going with that one?
Yeah, no, obviously when you're a wet rider, you got to be real, real smooth.
His style lends itself to that kind of technique. So I think he was better at finding the grip that was available in the conditions. Although they say the asphalt there at Le Mans is very grippy. but you can't see that part on TV because you can't see the minute of what a guy's doing with his throttle hand and what he's trying to do. It's kind of difficult, but I think that it was a great race by McPhee. I think it was a great race by De La Porta, great race by Kennett. I mean, it was a good Moto 3 race. It had the classic chaos at the end that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. It did, and it had a good mix of riders, ones that we're used to seeing up there, some maybe not so much. But definitely, this is going to be, you know, another exciting year of Moto 3. We did have some fallers, unfortunately, that it was a bit of a race of attrition. We lost Foggia, Alonso Lopez, Tatsuki Suzuki, of course, we had mentioned, Tony Arbolino, Vicente Perez, Nicolò Antonelli, Ramona Fanati, Marcos Ramirez, Ricardo Rossi, Darren Binder. I mean, that was a lot of guys. We lost Binder early, and that was a shame. He had a bad qualifying. I think he was pushing awfully hard to get to the front, and he was hard on the brakes, and, well, Binder bend it. Thank you.
He's here all weeks, folks. Chip your wickers.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. And with that, I think I'll just move on to the championship so I don't embarrass myself any further. Eric Kennett with that podium finish there, extensively leading the championship. He's 14 points in front of Lorenzo De La Porta. Nicolò Antonelli with that crash, unfortunately, falls back to third, just another 3 points behind him. Kaito Toba is in fourth. Juan Macias in fifth. Celestino Viette, I think. Celestino Vietti. Pretty sure that's a better way of saying that instead of rushing through the names. Take a second, Skyler, and just sound it out. Andrea Migno in seventh, Gabriel Rigo in eighth, John McPhee in ninth, courtesy of that win, and Darren Binder, like we had just mentioned, who had crashed, is now in 10th in the championship. All right, let's get on to some Moto2 qualifying, because there is one guy I really do kind of want to talk about who I think at the beginning of the season we all wondered if he was still going to be considered not necessarily in the hunt for the championship, but just in the Moto2 paddock next year, really. And that's Jorge Navarro. I mean, Moto3, or Jorge Navarro was very, very strong. We got used to him being in front. We're like, oh, this guy's going to be good when he goes to Moto2. And we just, poof, you know, it's, people make those jumps, right? Everyone has their ceiling. And we thought maybe Jorge Navarro's ceiling was Moto3. Moto2 is just not his game. Nah, that's out the window. He's looking good now.
Yeah, he was. The qualifying, again, following in the kind of rainy conditions was definitely dry, and so everybody was on slicks. But you had Luthi, Dixon, Tulovich, and Navarro all coming out of that first session to go to the second session. And the second session, the people were sort of need to mention that Lowe's crashed in the first session, so he wasn't able to make it into the second session. So
real quick, I'm just gonna go ahead and stop the recording there. I'm going to go ahead and copy what you just said, and I'm going to just make a file, because I'm pretty sure you're going to keep saying Lowe's crash. Oh, that's just mean. That's just
mean.
It's too easy. It's low-hanging fruit. Oh, man. Oh, we're going to get some. Have a lot of our donators are British. I'm going to catch some shit
yes,
this
you
week.
Will.
Anyway, continue on.
So in the second session, it was sort of up and down who was going to go where with the guys. Luthi kind of came through, and he had gotten himself to pole, and then he crashed. So you're like, okay, does Luthi have enough to actually stay there the whole time? Because time was running down. There wasn't a whole lot left. And it just so happened that that guy, Navarro, I hear he might be pretty good, he kind of went through and just did pimp Luthi to take the pole. So that was good. But then Navarro went down too after he took pole. So there's kind of a theme going there. But it wound up with Navarro being fast enough to take pole from Luthi. And then you had Marquez, Pacini, Verhey, Locatelli, and Baldassari, our championship leader. Binder looking decent on the KTM. They were doing much better with that whole new frame and everything, so that wasn't good for the team. Then you had Tulovac in ninth, and Schroeder finished 10th, and that is qualifying.
Yeah, Marcel Schroeder not really continuing on with his strong qualifying form. This was definitely a down qualifying for Schroeder standards. 10th is still not bad in a field of 30, but you know, that's for him. He's been, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4,
mm-hmm.
five, six, seven, eight, nobody doubt. He's been up in the top two rows, I think, for most of the season as far as qualifying goes. So, and then he wasn't really a factor in the race at all, which we can get to right now. Yeah. You know, with these new bikes, mm-hmm. Jim, definitely more power. And I think this weekend really showed us that that was on display because what was there, like five high sides in Moto2? Locatelli got the party started early. Yeah. He had a massive high side there in the chicane. I mean, to the moon. He came back down with snow when he hit the ground.
Come back down. I've never heard he came back down with snow on the ground. I was going to say he got altitude sickness, but okay. Either one of those works. But yeah, I'm wondering...
Pick your pun.
I'm wondering if the fact that they have a motorcycle now that has a lot more torque just by the design of the motor... Mm-hmm. If that, coupled with a limited traction control idea, if these guys aren't just thinking they've got to be sort of just turn the throttle wide open and the electronics are going to kind of cover everything and keep them in line, which it's not, and they shouldn't have electronics that do that. So I'm wondering if you take into consideration the cold track, which you'd almost want to run like sort of a wet mapping to kind of soften the bike a little bit so it doesn't hit as hard, but then you may not have as much power for the long straightaways that you have at Le Mans. So maybe they were just having trouble finding the sweet spot between too much traction control and not having enough power and speed versus too little traction control and being on the edge of the high side and not having enough wrist control coupled with cold tires and cold racetracks. It just is maybe like the perfect storm of things that cause some of the crashing.
Yeah, no, sure. I think you argued with yourself in your own statement there and got all your answers out at once. I think you covered every base into why that might have happened. But yeah, no, I totally agree. It's getting trickier to ride these bikes for sure. And that's what Moto2 really did need, right? It seemed like people were making it too easy, and these bikes are not easy. Yet, these guys, I'm sure, will adapt and sharpen that knife edge. Luthi, bringing all his experience to the table, got out to the early lead, but then got to a really scary one that involved Baldessari and Pacini. Baldessari went down, and he lost the front end going over the curb there. Really scary because when you crash early in the race, you got a lot of riders behind you. Unfortunately, when he went down, he was right in the way of Matteo Pacini. Pacini's front tire clipped the back of Baldessari's head. Looked like it knocked him unconscious as he went flopping kind of through the gravel. Caused Pacini to go down. He came up, looked like he was holding his wrist as he limped over to the sidelines. Just not a good thing to see when riders go down and they get, especially when they get smacked in the head or if they get ran over, period. It's always a scary thing.
Yeah, it's scary. I had a quick flashback to the Simoncelli crash. I mean, they're obviously two different crashes, but I had that same gut feeling like I just didn't want to see it. I didn't want to watch the replays again because it was too close for comfort. Marquez looked good. He definitely had it hooked up, and when anybody did kind of settle themselves in and try to make a run for him, they couldn't catch him, or he was at least able to up his pace enough to make things seem better for him to where he could go faster, which is kind of demoralizing to the people that are chasing you. If you put in a fast lap, red helmets, and then the guy ahead of you can do it again on the next lap when he sees his board that you took a tenth or two out of him and he puts it right back on you, that can be a demoralizing thing, which just showed that, you know, he really had things hooked up. But that 2-3-4 battle was pretty sweet because you had Navarro in there on the speed up, and that was looking for speed ups. Third consecutive podium if he could do it. And then you had Fernandez there who was riding really pretty good and has been riding good the last couple of weekends. He's definitely on for a win somewhere. It's just not happening here. And then you had Binder with the KTM chassis there with them. So whatever KTM welded together, they've got that working pretty well. But you got to feel that Baldessari would have been in there somewhere. So maybe Baldessari correct it. Maybe Binder finishes one or two places farther back than he did in the race.
Tough to tell, especially with those, with the way, how's it going to look in the beginning versus how it's going to look in the end, because we thought Luffy was going to be up there, and he dropped back like a stone. Like, I don't even know what really happened to him. He went flying backwards. Unfortunately, Sam Lowe's, you know, he had crashed at this point during the race as well. But Corsi, man, the way he ran down Marquez, I was like, man, Corsi's having a good week. Oh, shit. There he goes.
Yep.
And just dug into the gravel. That was the end of that. I was like, oh, I guess he found the limit. He was pushing hard to catch Marquez and literally just got onto the back of him and maybe needed to give himself just a bit of a breather and then just unfortunately wiped it out.
Yeah. I wonder if he had burned up the front because he seemed like he was riding it where he's just maybe more aggressive on the front tire and the way that he approaches things a little bit. Maybe he just didn't have enough grip after that. Just that's as simple as that, and down you go. Or it could be the fact that you're just at the limit and you're on a track that's cold and you can make those small little mistakes and just leave it just that last little tenth of a second later on the brakes trying to gain that little bit and you'll go down, you'll fold the front. So not really sure which way it was, but man, it would have been great if you could have caught Marquez.
Yeah, you know, Fernandez and Chavi Verhey, man, they had a good battle going on there for a while. They were banging fenders and cutting each other pretty good in the corners once again. It was leading to Marquez to getting out there a little bit. At this point, especially when Corsi went down, man, I think the gap jumped back up to like over 2 seconds. And at that point, Marquez was just head down, do your laps, don't worry about what's behind you, and kind of bring it home. Dude, did you see Bollega's save as he went through the gravel?
I don't remember that one. I must have missed that.
He runs off, I think, at turn 6, I believe, which is one of the faster corners, if I'm getting the numbers right. But went straight through the gravel at like 130 kilometers
an hour. Really? Or something. I must have like missed that.
And was just kind of, I mean, just, you know, kept it straight and kept it going. Ended up making it all the way through to the other side and back onto the track. You got, and of course, the easy thing the announcers did, which is the same thing I would have said, is, oh, looks like all that time at Rossi's Ranch is paying off.
That's good.
Yeah, it probably is.
Man, where was I during that part of the race? Totally missed that one.
Yeah, no, it's one of those, it was, I think, during one of the, you know, the guys kind of spread out, you know, the break in between the action kind of points. I just remember seeing that because I was looking up and they had made the joke and I saw him bouncing through. But getting back to Navarro, like I said, he even took his turn at running Marquez down. But unfortunately he pushed it too hard, blew a corner, almost pulled a Corsi, but kept it all together. But then again, you know, it was kind of like all the hard work, it's gone. Marquez kept it out front, grabbed a solid in control when Navarro ended up getting back around, Augusto Fernandez, who definitely pestered him quite a bit. Man, Augusto Fernandez is having himself a season, and he also finished above his teammate's championship rival, which in the terms of team, that's what you do. That will get you a check at the end of the day. If you can't lead the championship and you're the number two, your job is to protect the number one. He's doing it, and he's getting faster and faster.
Yep. I want to just talk about the speed up chassis. I'm impressed because the speed up we've known has always had great edge grip, which is great on tracks like Jerez, where you've got long, flowing, sweeping corners. You really don't have long, sweeping, flowing corners, except for maybe the bend in the front stretch that they call turn one and turn two before you get to the chicane, before the Dunlap Bridge. Most of that circuit is...
Well, La Chapelle too, but that's the only two.
But the thing is that it's a very point and squirt, short circuit kind of thing. And for the speed up to actually work really well there was really impressive. And with the way Navarro was riding, it was really impressive. So, you know, you look at it, the only other speed up was DG Antonio, and he was 12th. I mean, so something good going on there. And, you know, I'm hoping that we're going to see the resurgence of KTM in the class because, you know, Bender finished fourth with the KTM chassis. You had Lekawona was there in ninth, which isn't too bad. He's, you know, there's five places, but man, the other Red Bull you know, KTM chassis are all down there like 17, 18, 19, 20. So they may not have gotten the new chassis that the other guys got. So, you know, still work to be done there, but man, it's not.
Yeah, and Jorge Martin, he crashed out. Yeah. He was definitely up higher, but he ended up crashing and remounting. But definitely, I think you're right. I think the upgrades haven't come to the other bikes, and probably by the next race, especially with the test going on this weekend, and now they get a little more time with that frame, they're probably going to start marching the way back to the front, which they need to. We need them up there doing their thing to make these more interesting. We don't need the Calix Cup to
that's
come
true.
Back. We need these guys.
Well, that's why I love the speed up doing their thing, man. I love that.
Exactly. They definitely had a resurgence with Quartararo last year, and it's great to see that Navarro is continuing on with that. But Alex Marquez getting the win, Jorge Navarro there in second, Augusto Fernandez finishing out the podium in third. Like we said, Binder in fourth, Xavi Verhey had a nice solid race to fifth, Tom Luthi ended up regaining some of himself back to sixth place there, Enea Bastianini in seventh, Marshall Schwader eighth, Iker Lecuona in ninth, Nicola Bellega in tenth, and Tetsuya Nakashima in 11th. That leads us at the championship here to like the luckiest guy ever who's crashed out of two races and still somehow has managed to keep the lead in the championship, and that's Baldessari over Tom Luthi. Man, Luthi, swinging and miss on this weekend, buddy. This was your chance to take a big chunk out of that. Did not happen.
That was disappointing that he's actually crashed twice like that and then was still able to lead the points, which either shows you that Baldessari has a massive domination over the class, or everybody else just can't get it together and be consistent. So, you know, one of the things you should take advantage of your rivals when they're actually down and put points on the board, and he failed to do that. And I hope it does not come back to bite him at the end, and he winds up losing this championship by, a handful of points or less.
Now, the big dogs, MotoGP, Q1. Was interesting because Rossi went out there. It's like, oh, that's a damp track. Cool. I'm going to go out there on slicks. You're going to do what, dude? Everyone else is like, ha, you're a fool. We're not going to do that. Even I was like, this guy, all these years, gets a guy to do anything. Well, shit. The man was 100% on the money with this call.
Oh, yeah. He's got balls bigger than anybody else in that paddock because to go out on slicks was pretty impressive, and do what he did was even more impressive considering that everyone else said, no, you need wets. And to top it off, Marquez had fallen off an FP4 when the track was pretty slick and slimy. So, that takes a lot of courage and a lot of faith that you have made the right call, especially being a 15-minute session. You don't, if you're caught in the rain on slicks and you can't make the slick work, there's not enough time. Well, I guess they got both bikes and you could come back and get a bike that actually has slicks, has wets on it, but you got to get back around on slick tires without falling off and all that. So there's not a whole lot of time there, but kudos to Rossi for pulling that one off.
Because of that, though, when we got to Q2, the teams were all like, well, shit, what are we going to do? Everybody's like, oh, some people are like, I'll go on slicks. And they'd be like, we're going rains. And it took about half a lap for everybody to go like, well, slicks were not a good decision. We should have just did the rain tires. That was a mistake.
Yeah. All the Yamahas got caught out in that
sure
one.
Sure did.
Because they all looked at what Rossi had done. So when they started Q2, Rossi went on slicks. So did Vinales. So did Quartararo. So did Morbidelli. And quite a lot of other people did the same thing. And I can't blame you. I mean, you got to kind of look, and it's kind of a monkey see, monkey do kind of thing. If you can do it, then, you know, we can do it too. Yeah. You know, that was one of my favorite things, is like you had a track that was like kind of wet for me. I loved having a wet front and a slick rear because as a dirt tracker, I didn't care where the back end was going. I just needed to know where the front end was going. So I wish, and you can't do that in MotoGP. I think you have to have the same tire front and rear. If it's a rain, you got to have a rain front and a rain rear. I don't think they let you split them like that. But, you know, then they had the big question about, well, shouldn't we have intermediate tires back again? Because Michelin only brought a medium compound rain and a soft rain to Le Mans. And Simon Crafer was talking to the head of Michelin, who the name escapes me right now. It's French and I probably couldn't pronounce it anyway. But he said that no, they redid the construction of the tire and they redid the compound of the medium tire. And it's as close to an intermediate as you could get. And it was going to be, so he said, quote, the perfect tire for these conditions. And well, yeah, it was for those conditions because the people who were out on that tire did their thing. And that was like Marquez. He went out there, set a pole lap on it, and looked really good. Came around for a second flying lap, and then did what Mark Marquez does best. He falls off again. And he almost saved it. He tried. Oh, he tried, he tried, he tried. He went with that one all the way to the gravel trap, but nope, couldn't save it.
But we saw, because it was tricky conditions, like I had predicted earlier this year in tricky conditions, Daniel Petrucci was going to get his shot towards the front, and he definitely nailed that, getting there in second. Jack Miller, always a good in the wet weather rider. He finished there. He was another one that set his time and then also threw it away and hit into the ground as the rain started coming up a little bit there. But it was, you know, Dovizioso there in fourth. You know, Ducatis definitely do well in the wet and tricky conditions. They were backed by Rossi, Morbidelli, Nakagami, Lorenzo, Espargaro, Fabio Quartararo. Maverick Vinales did not have a great qualifying time. And usually they're like, oh, why is that a surprise? He hasn't had that great a year. Well, it's because he led, I think, 3 out of 4 sessions coming into qualifying. And when they got there and they got the wet tires on there, the setup was definitely a miss for the team and Maverick, which did not lead to the greatest starting positions. And we all know Maverick cannot have a bad qualifying position because his starts are just not good.
Yeah, the kind of bike you needed was a bike with wet suspension settings with slick tires on it. That's the bike that you wanted to have. And I don't think Maverick got that because I think he went out on his race bike for on his first bike, and it had slicks, and I think it probably had a dry type setup on it suspension wise. And then when he went back in, you know, it just wasn't, he didn't have what he needed because now it was too soft because he had, you know, the wets and a soft suspension on it and couldn't make it work. And that was the other thing too during the qualifying, was there was a lot of guys you saw, the mechanics with the spanners, and they were taking preload out of the bikes or putting preload into the bikes depending on where they were, because that's one of the big differences that you want, is you want things to be a little more softer, a little more plush, and let it have the suspension be a little bit more compliant. So you tend to take, you know, you take like maybe 1 or 2 turns of preload off the springs in the front. You may even go so much as to change and make the rebound on the suspension a little softer so it comes back and the compression, so that it absorbs the bumps a little bit smoother and doesn't essentially, you know, kind of deflect off of it. But it was really cool just to see the mechanics just hustling to try to make these changes, and nobody really knew what to do and everyone's kind of guessing. But it's kind of cool for me from an engineering side of it to see like everything's got marks on it, so they know exactly how many turns it takes, so that everything's lined up exactly where they want it. And they've all got a plan, and they're all going to attack that bike. And it's amazing that they've got 4 guys around a motorcycle that aren't bumping into each other and do exactly what they need to do and get it done in, you know, 35, 40 seconds. It's pretty doggone cool to watch. And I enjoyed that part of qualifying immensely.
Yeah, no, it was definitely great work there by the teams. And it shows you that the top teams will get to the top because of the work that they do. It's not an individual sport all the time. The teams do make a big difference.
It's all about the prep that you put into it, too.
Yes, sir. Speaking of prep, now we got to the MotoGP race, and there's a theme. Rain is coming, or was it? We got there's a few drops. It's like, okay, here comes the rain everyone's been talking about. No. This stayed away again. But what was really weird, warm-up lap. They cut to it, and Mir and Abraham have had a crash. And you're like, okay, who ran into who?
Yeah, that was my first thought, too.
You're like, okay. And then they go back, and I think Zarco had his camera. They were looking back, and they both just locked the front. Now, Carol Abraham, he locked his first, which I maybe thought for a second that caused Mir to like react and grab a handful of brake. But to be honest, it almost looked like 2 separate crashes that happened exactly at the same time.
I agree with that statement. I thought the same thing. I thought, oh, you know, Mir saw Abraham And then he grabbed a little bit more because he wanted to be sure that he wasn't going to run over or hit the bike or make an adjustment. But I agree with you. Watching it back a few times, it looked like two simultaneous crashes. It was just like synchronized crashing, like they planned it. So, you know, here we are, chaos at the beginning already. You know, just as a thought, I've never ridden carbon fiber brakes. I mean, most of us will never, ever experience that.
Really? But you haven't?
No,
Chip,
I guess.
Where have you been? Come on. Come on. The dime a dozen.
Yeah, that's right. You know, they have to be at a really high core temperature to actually work properly. That's why you saw everybody have their covers on them to keep the heat in the discs. And I wonder if it was one of those things where they didn't get them warm enough, and when they pulled that last time, it finally became hot and suddenly worked. Like they say, they're like turning on a light switch. They're sort of off, 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 and then they're on. And I'm wondering if that maybe, you know, it being cold tire and all that, that maybe that was a contributing factor to those guys. Because this is Mir's rookie season and you know, there isn't does Moto 2 doesn't have carbons, do they, on there? Because I know Moto3's got steels.
No, I don't think
they do. I think the only people who've got carbons is MotoGP. So that's a whole other learning experience, how to warm up your tire and your brakes and get all that ready to go. So that could have, you know, in a cold track, that kind of thing, you're sketchy on the amount of grip that the tire has to begin with. That could have been what caught Mir out. Now, Abraham's had enough experience that he really shouldn't have made that mistake. So I don't know what, you know, happened there. I could give you an excuse for Mir, but I just can't give you a good one for Abraham.
Maybe because he should be a Moto 2 rider. This guy just coming with these just stings. Even though he can't do shit on a racetrack, he sure does have a lot to say about people that do it way better than him. Pundit.
Let's actually start the race.
We get back to a bit of a frantic start. Dude, Morbidelli, it went unnoticed on the broadcast, at least from what I remember. But, dude, that guy, he gained like 5 spots in the first chicane and kind of slipped up through. I thought that was a really nice move. I just wanted to mention that. It was good. It was a nice one.
It's a way to take advantage of what happens in front of you. I mean, it's always going to be that concertina effect right there. And if you can sell it, you know, sell that dummy that, I had to go here to avoid problems, you're probably going to get away with it. Most of the guys at Race Control, just because they understand it's chaos on that first lap. And it wasn't really egregious, and it was pretty sly, and you know, more power to you.
Exactly. So, and then of course, you know, Marquez gets out front and you're like, oh man, that didn't take long. But then, Jack Miller started to hustle Marquez.
Oh,
as soon
yeah.
as I was like, oh, he started to hustle him. He gets past him. And the first question that always comes to my mind when I see Miller out front of Rochong, it's like, is he going to keep it up? Come on, dude, keep it up. I want to see you beat this guy. Like, I really do like this guy. Come on, man. And they had a great battle. I mean, they booed up, and then Marquez finally was like, all right, dude, well, I'm done with you. I'm going to kind of get away from you now. And maybe Jack's tires were starting to go out, or he was starting to realize, like, hey, maybe I need to watch after my tires a little bit. And started to back off a little bit, giving Marquez some space. But then we had a crash when they showed Vignala in the gravel trap kind of looking off in the distance, like, what the hell happened? And he got hit again for another race. Bagnaia unfortunately ran into him. But this is the cliche thing we always talk about in racing. Bad qualifying led to this crash.
That's right.
He was back there with the rookies, and he got hit by one. That's what happens when you don't qualify well.
Yeah.
I mean, the qualifying obviously is not a cause of the crash, but one definitely, you put yourself at greater risk when you're back there.
Look at it this way. Marquez has said it before, and the commentating team has said it, the race begins on Friday. You have to understand that everything that happens, and this is, you know, I've wasted enough superlatives on Marquez over the course of these podcasts, but this is where this kid shines with his team. They go out on Friday, they immediately try to figure out how to go fast. And what do you see Marquez doing? He's always pushing, trying to find the limit to figure out where in the world he is with that bike. And from that point forward, he's making sure that he knows what to do when it comes to Saturday and he's time for qualifying. He's prepared and ready to go. How many times have you seen Marquez throw it away in FP4? Because he's found the absolute limit of what's possible. He comes back to the pits, gets on his bike, goes backup bike, goes out and does it again. He's always ready to be on, you know, when's the last time you saw Marquez qualify off the second row? I can't, off the top of my head, I can't tell you when that was.
No, that's a Harry Lloyd question. Skyler doesn't, no, Skyler's got about a week of memory in him and that's about it.
But that's the thing, is that, you know, Marquez is working towards all of these things, and him and his team have developed some very systematic, methodical way that they work through it, because it's very rare on Friday's first practice session that Marquez is actually leading anybody. And he's there or near the top, and it works for them. It's like Richard Childress from NASCAR said, you know, luck is when preparation meets opportunity. Well, here's all the preparation that Marquez and his team are putting into the race, and when the opportunity presents itself, they go out and they win. And that's Vinales. I mean, Vinales and Yamaha have had trouble qualifying, and when they do, and you're back there, like you said, bad things clobbered by it, and he's down. And now his championship's taking a real beating now by not getting any points in that one.
Yeah, and the fact that he hasn't had really strong of a run to this point, it makes me doubtful that he's going to all of a sudden turn around and claw back. It's tough because, you know, championship, I mean, just finishing in the top three at this point, because Marquez, when we get to the points later, the gap doesn't look that big, but it's only because of what Marquez has allowed, and that's about it. Complete control when he's out of control.
Okay, sure,
dude. So one of the things I had noticed. So we've got two things here that I wanted to talk about. Quartararo, I think he's the real thing, because he didn't have a great start, sat in the back. But when he did start moving towards the front, he was flying all towards. So he kind of pulled a Vinales, right? Bad start, got going at the end.
No, he had bad qualifying. Because again, Yamaha made a decision to put everybody out in Q2 on slicks when it was the wrong thing to do. But I get where they were. I'd probably, if I was Yamaha, had made the same decision. But same thing with Vinales. You're starting in the back of the pack. So now you've got to deal with everything that is there. You need two or three laps to sort out everybody and get into your groove and get things going. And when Quartararo did, he was fantastic. That boy.
He set the fastest lap of the race. And at the end of the race, for the last seven laps, he was faster than anybody else on track.
No, Marquez was not being pressured by anybody. But right now,
this is true.
I am chomping at the bit to watch Quartararo go after Marquez because
he's crazy enough to do it.
He is. And the question becomes, is Marquez smart enough to realize he's not his championship contender yet?
That's to see. I would like to say that Marquez would sit behind him for a while, but given the last five laps, if he's anywhere near sniffing a race win, Marquez is going to give the business.
There's no question about that.
Marquez in second don't mix well. Marquez in first. That's pretty much it.
Maybe what we're going to see is a Marquez Quartararo rivalry emerge where we never really have gotten the Vinales Marquez rivalry that everybody talked about as soon as he got onto the Yamaha. You know, I'm a big Honda guy. I love Marquez. I think the guy is amazing. But I want to see somebody step up to Marquez's level and beat him at his own game. And right now, it might be Quartararo.
It's the king is always on top. You always want to see the king. Someone take it to the king, right?
Sure.
When Rossi was up there. Everyone led him for a while, but when Lorenzo came, it was like, ooh, challenger, right? Same thing kind of happens now. It's like Marquez is getting there because he gets stale, and any time that comes up there can almost knock him off his pedestal. I mean, I bet you Dovizioso's fan base has quadrupled in the last 3 years. Just because people are like, oh man, he's going to take down Mark. He's going to take down Mark. He's lovable. He's a complete opposite guy. It's like, dude, Marquez really isn't that bad of a guy. He's had some dumb mistakes, but he's not a bad guy. And people try to paint him into this enemy because they just want somebody to beat. Yeah, it's how just stories go. You got to have a hero
and a villain. Right? And,
That's what I meant to say. Villain, yes.
Yep.
Now, second thing, looping back to what I was talking about. dude, you know what I saw? Because I'm trying to figure out, like, where's Lorenzo's pace been at? Obviously, he's got to get used to the Honda. He's still recovering from injury, but where's it lacking? I finally saw it. He's horrible on the brakes right now.
Yep.
He's got no confidence in the front of that Honda. I mean, it was bad. Quattro outbroke him by 20 freaking meters, dude.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it was a huge, like,
hole. It was so visible there on that. What were they going into that? That's the chicane at after the museum corner. Who cares? It was a head-on shot, and you saw Quartararo throttle down, head down, throttle on, head down, and all of a sudden, vroom, Lorenzo sits up. Like, dude, wait a second. All of a sudden, I'm like, oh, I guess Quartararo missed a brake marker. Nope, Quartararo just flew right through that corner.
And that was his thing, right? That was Yama. He was a deep breaker because he would break deep and, like, roll off and just keep that corner speed and be gone.
It's the same problem he had in the Ducati. Same thing. He was not comfortable on the brakes. And, you know, this is what. See if I can get my thoughts straight here so I get this right. What happened with the Ducati was he was fatiguing with his arms because he was having to hold up everything with it. And
that's right.
He finally got his positioning correct and everything and got the chest pad or whatever it was or the way the gas tank was shaped to help support himself. So he wasn't fatiguing when he was trying to brake on the Ducati. And he won races, looked good at it. Then he jumped on the Honda. And then Crutchlow made the comment. He says, yeah, Lorenzo doesn't know what he's in for. He doesn't understand how much he's going to have to use his shoulders and his arms on that bike. And I thought that was a really weird statement by Cal. You know, I'm thinking, you know, I'm trying to think, like, in braking, you're going to need that, you know, but it's not really your shoulders. What, you know, what's Cal getting on about? Well, yeah, it is. That's how you have to ride the Honda, apparently, to make it go fast, is you have to have incredibly strong upper body shoulder muscles, which is a very small muscle in your body. It's not like a bicep muscle or something like that. It's a very small muscle. It's very hard to work that muscle and get it super strong, especially for, like, what they're braking with, one or 1.5 G's of deceleration. That's an insane amount of force that can be done. But Lorenzo is not happy at all on that bike in braking, and I don't know if there's anything he can do to his own body. Like, I don't think he could train any harder to do it. It's not like he's not in shape, kind of a thing, unless the wrist is fatiguing a little bit and he's having to take up some of that pressure from the wrist with his sort of his bicep and his shoulder, which is kind of what you would naturally want to do. But you'd think that Honda would be able to build a gas tank or a pad or adjust the bike in some way or some fashion to really help him, because he knows what he needs in a motorcycle to go fast. And he's trying to make a Honda into a Yamaha, just like he tried to make a Ducati into a Yamaha. He succeeded at Ducati to do it, but even then he said it wouldn't turn. Because remember, Lorenzo drew the track, his track, and it's just four square corners, right? And then he kind of said, well, what's it going to be like on the Honda? He had a squiggly racetrack. Well, it's going to be great because the Honda turns. And it's like, I think he's finding out that it doesn't really turn like he thinks it turns. Or you know, it's a combination of things, right? I mean, Honda has built a motorcycle that's incredibly fast, but again, you have one guy who can ride it, Marquez. And so he does it very, very well. But there's been so much work done to soften and make that Honda more rideable for other people. You know, Crutchlow's won races on that bike when Marquez hasn't, and sort of the stars align. Crutchlow is just as fast and looks really good on it. And now you got Lorenzo, and as much as I want Lorenzo to figure it out and fix it, I don't know if Honda has enough patience to wait as long as Ducati did for that time.
Ooh, look at this segue. Look at that. Right to the rumor that Honda had given, which I don't think this is true, but Honda had given Lorenzo an ultimatum. Basically, get your shit together or get out. We'll replace you. Now, there's so many things. First of all, I think that's either Spanish or Italian media going crazy. Because, one, they've got a five-time champion at a super discounted price. They've already got number one on the team.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you going to bring in? What is the point of getting rid of him? Who's coming up? Who's out there right now? You're like, yeah, definitely better than Lorenzo.
Hey, I'd put Brattle on the bike, right? Brattle was fine in Jerez. He looked good.
Yeah, Brattle.
Brattle deserves a ride. Derek and I agreed to that. You and I maybe haven't that, but I mean, you could conceivably.
I say he deserves a bike more than Carroll.
Okay, fine.
I'll say that.
But back to like the Honda scenario with this. If you're Honda, your whole thing is that you've won championships with Marquez, but you really have not won a manufacturer's championship. Your whole concept was to take Lorenzo, put him on there, and have him finishing in the 2-3-4 spot every weekend while Marquez is off winning you races by 20 seconds. It isn't working. And at some point, Honda's got to sit there and go, you know, this is really great, but we can't let Yamaha keep taking a manufacturer's title, or sorry, letting Ducati take a manufacturer's title away from us. They want that title too. I mean, HRC goes racing because it's Honda Racing Corporation. They want to win what is theirs. They want that constructor's crown. And they want to prove that they have the best bike. And they haven't done it in the Marquez era. They haven't won one. So, maybe they have. Somebody will be yelling at me. No, they won this one that year or whatever. But the point is...
Yeah, it's probably Lynn.
Lynn yelling at us right now. But the point of that is that you have a guy that you thought was going to fill that bill of what you need to have a successful team championship, and you're not getting it. So, yeah, I can see where the rumors come from, but did they really tell him that? Probably not.
Nah.
I mean,
it's too early for that. At least get halfway through this season. I mean, he's coming off an injury, too. But anyway, enough of that because the race was, man, getting towards the end of this race, we have diverted heavily. But we kind of got there. Taka Nakagami, he crashed out. Dovizioso and Petrucci had a nice battle where Dovizioso got in front of him, kept it out there. Marquez brings it home in front of Dovizioso and Daniel Petrucci and in front of Jack Miller. So Ducati there in 2-3-4. Great showing. Rossi started fifth, finished fifth, solid race. But the man of the day.
Yeah, baby. Cole Spargo. KTM.
Yep. Bringing home KTM's best finish in MotoGP in sixth place and didn't earn it because somebody crashed, didn't earn it because they had the right setup. They may have had a slight advantage because they were there testing just before that, but doesn't matter. Paul Espargaro still got out there, went out there, set it, and he looked good in sixth place.
It was nice, a great ride.
Solid ride.
So from what I heard, that what KTM has found, and it was in Matt Oxley's article when it came out today on Motorsports Magazine, can KTM survive in MotoGP or something like that? He said that the new carbon fiber swing arm that KTM made for the bike gives consistent grip or consistent feel with the tire the whole way through. So now Paul can actually ride, he could always have one lap speed because you get a fresh tire and you can, as Kenny Roberts Jr. famously said, anybody can ride a piece of shit to first place for one lap. It's being able to use that tire and manage that tire. So they've either looked at the carbon fiber swing arm and they've tweaked the composite layup and the fibers in there to where either they're getting more flex or less flex, or they're making it somehow more compliant so that the Michelin tire isn't worked as hard. So now it's a consistent feel for Paul, and he knows that he can predict what's going to happen, which is the most important thing for the riders, to have that confidence as he's riding, that he knows that the tire is going to degrade, but you want it to degrade linearly. You want it to degrade like radiation does. It has a certain half-life, and you know how long that's going to be, and that's how you want race tires to work. You want to know that half-life of that tire so that you know what to do with it as you're going and what you got to control with your wrist. And I'm really hoping now that if they've got this chassis thing kind of sorted now, KTM can kind of start looking at getting the acceleration and the horsepower out of it, which with these new motors and spinning them backwards, or a crank that rotates in the opposite direction of the way the wheels rotate, it takes a little bit of work to get those motors to get horsepower back. Honda will tell you that, because when they switched and made theirs run backwards, they didn't quite have the acceleration and didn't have the top end that Ducati had. And they had to go back to the drawing board and they had to work on it to make it work right. And, you know, we're going to see if KTM can now shape up with the motor side of it too. And the other part of it is as well is that their suspension, they run White Power because they own White Power. And, you know, they don't have the decades worth of book knowledge to actually know what to do like Ohlins does. I think Ohlins came in to solve Kenny Roberts' really nasty handling Yamaha back in 1983. I think that's the first time Ohlins was on a factory bike. So they've got from like 1983 to now where they just open up books and notes and go, "Huh, yeah, well, try this." And, you know, makes a good fun.
Or walk down two garages and there's the other bike, you know. How many teams are running it? They've got a huge support staff at every single race, too.
I mean, I think, you know, I'm a KTM fan, and I love the fact that they had
to, yes, no,
that they've made real, what looks to be like real progress. Like they found sort of the magic bullet, and I really hope that it keeps going like this. I'd love to see Paul riding, you know, in that 4, 5, 6 range throughout the year. And I think it's great because now it's a Honda, it's a Ducati, it's a Yamaha. Oh, and hey, here's a KTM now running around right there.
This is Suzuki outside of this weekend will be up there too.
Yeah, not a great weekend for Rins them, just but looks like he lost the plot. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. They missed the setup. I think they were wrong for Friday, went the wrong way, and never ever got back to where they needed to.
You got the sweetest handed motorcycle on the grid on a track that it should absolutely positively shine at, and it didn't go anywhere. And you're going, what? I know Rins had problems with qualifying, but I thought, all right, fine. Rins will wind up actually getting it solved, and they'll come to the front. And it never happened. They just floundered, which is, I hope Suzuki looks better when they get to Mugello, but I think they're still at a small horsepower disadvantage, so I would expect it to be a Honda Ducati kind of battle there. But
Rins
could get on a podium there as long as he gets the setup right. Because again, you've got some fast, flowy corners, great handling, better edge grip, get you more acceleration, so you can at least get off the corner better to kind of stay with them or stay in the draft and make them work for it. So.
We get down to them. It's Marquez, Dovizioso, Miller, Rossi. Blah, 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 blah. Right? Feeling good. Race. Let's get the championship. Wait, did I just say this? Marquez, Dovizioso. Oh, hey, it's almost the same thing. This is sounding familiar. But yes, you would think. Now, don't think about like all the results, but just think about the season overall. And you know Marquez leading the championship. In your mind, because you're thinking Marquez, the way he dominates, he's got a huge lead in the championship at this point, right? Not really. Like, oh, wait. Well, he had his crash. And Dovizioso, being Dovizioso, has been kind of just making his bad weekends okay weekends, which is always good. He's only 8 points behind. Nothing. That's nothing. That's one waste.
That's one Marquez, you know, crash away from
bad tire.
That's from, you know, Dovizioso leading. But Dovizioso admitted that Ducati has work to do and that they need to find something.
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. No, it's if when Marquez doesn't crash, basically Marquez has to slow down to win races. That's not a good thing. When everyone else has to get faster, he just needs to slow it down to win it. What? What? How does that work?
Yeah.
How are you that much better right now? And it's not the bike. I mean, it's him and the bike, sure. But, dude, the other Hondas, nowhere up there. That guy is just, man, like you said, I've run out of different ways to explain how special that guy is. It's just amazing to watch.
Everyone should just sit back and love him or hate him. You have got to just witness it and watch it. You really need to go to a track and watch Marquez do what he does in live, because you can't imagine. You just don't understand.
Oh, yeah.
And you're so lucky to be living at this point to watch that and see it. And just, that's the part you need to revel in. It's like, man, this guy's just that damn good. And it's you know, it's incumbent upon everybody else. You know, he's moved the goalpost so far that it's going to take everybody else a little time to catch up there to it. But
shit, at this point they're on another field. I mean It's ridiculous he's going to have to work at that. But, you know, Dovizioso, he's sitting there in second, just the 8 points behind. Not too far back there, another 12 points back is Alex Rins. Rossi sitting there just with him. Pertucci, with that podium, gets himself up to fifth. Jack Miller falls back to sixth. Cavaccio sitting there seventh. Morbidelli eighth. Paul Espargaró in ninth, which is a really good top 10 with the KTM. That's good for them. And Maverick Viñales in 10th now. Season pretty much looking a wash. He's some 65 points behind Marquez at that point in the championship. So probably not going to be getting anywhere near. So, Jim, we have been talking and talking and talking. I think we need to get the hell out of here. If anybody's left, I mean, congratulations. I mean, you guys must really love to hear about motorcycles, or you have a long commute. Either way, we appreciate you. Don't forget, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. We're on Facebook. That's facebook.com/motopod. That is the Motopod fan page, so please get over there and like, and that's where we usually update. It hasn't been too active lately, but we'll get better at that. We're on Twitter at @moto_pod. You can follow us there for news, announcements, and motorcycle banter. I, of course, am at SkylarV28 on both Twitter and Instagram. Derek, one of our other hosts, he's at MotoDerekC on both Twitter and Instagram. Jim, where can people find you?
At MotoRGV, Twitter and Instagram.
Our boys across the pond, Andrew, he's at Andy_course. Dave Neal's at Dave Neal on Twitter and at the Dave Neal on Instagram. Go ahead and hit them up for getting, especially if you want to get caught up on the BSB news. Those guys do a great show. If you are not listening to the BSB shows because you don't have an interest in BSB, I suggest you take that attitude, rewind it, because those two guys do great work. And if you didn't already hear, Dave Neal's done such great work that he got himself onto a broadcast. He may be the next Harry Lloyd. We don't know. We don't know. A star is born.
Just remember, you all knew Dave Neal before Dave Neal was Dave Neal.
That's right. Before the Dave Neal was the Dave Neal. Anyway, Jim, I am just babbling on. We need to get the hell out of here, man. It was great talking with you again. Once again, folks, sorry for taking so long to get back to a regular show, but I'm going to take the next day and a half to edit this because we did a horrible job, and you guys have no idea how many times me and Jim screwed this up, but doesn't matter. You'll get the final product. All right, Jim, that's enough out of me.
Enough out of me, too. I'm done. It's late here.
All right, man. You get some sleep. I'm going to go see if my wife is still married to me.
Sounds like a plan.